Hi, everybody. Just a quick holiday season reminder. My book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession, is available everywhere books are sold and makes a great gift for the food or chef-obsessed person in your life, or a great use of that Amazon gift card somebody might have given you or be about to give you. It's the book The Wall Street Journal calls Fast, Furious, and Fun, that Salon.com calls a terrific history of chefs in America, and about which legendary food writer Ruth Reichel wrote, "It's impressive, I haven't read anything like it." That's Chef's Drugs and Rock and Roll. Happy holidays and happy reading.
This program is brought to you by Juul, sous vide by Chef Steps. Juul takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
It really started when I was at the Stanford Court, and having that experience of Switzerland and New Hampshire, I thought, well, you know, we really do have some great, simple, great desserts here. And so I would assess things, like banana cream pie was one.
That is legendary pastry chef Jim Dodge, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses
to make some sense of this.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am again alone today, but I think I'm getting better at doing these introductions by myself. I think I've developed an ability to imagine you all out there listening to this and to talk to you the way I usually need Caitlin here to address somebody. So I hope you're all doing well. I hope you're all enjoying the holiday season. Our guest today is Jim Dodge. And for those who don't know his name, Jim is one of the real pioneering pastry chefs of the American culinary scene who started going that route in the 1970s. And I'll get to a little bit more about Jim in just a moment. But first, just a couple of notes about the show. Bo Beck was my guest on the show that dropped on Saturday. And I've received a number of private messages and text messages and a comment or two from some people at the holiday gala the Heritage Network threw the other night, that they found Bo to be intense, overdramatic. Did I like him? What was that interview like? He seemed really just a little crazy. And I have to say, I didn't get any of that from Bo Beck. Bo, from the minute he walked in the room, could not have been nicer. We had an instant rapport. I do think he has a rather severe way of talking. It reminds me a little bit of the film director Werner Herzog. Some of you may have seen, maybe his best known recent work was Grizzly Man, which is already more than 10 years old. But I guess not being there in the room, you couldn't get just how absolutely friendly and smiling and jovial he actually was, or that's the energy he gave off. We had a great give and take. He was super complimentary before the interview and after, off mic. So I just want to say to anyone who found that interview to be intense or odd or melodramatic, I didn't. So I'm vouching for Bo as a good dude. I'm sorry if he came off that way. Okay, now, Jim Dodge is a pastry chef who, like I said, started off in the 1970s. He was most associated with the Stanford Court Hotel. That hotel still exists. It's at the top of Knob Hill in San Francisco. And it is under different ownership than it was back in the day. But it's a very important historic hotel. It's where James Beard used to stay when he was in San Francisco. Julia Child spent a lot of time there. And this was when these people were becoming the sort of legends and icons that they are today. And Jim was very much in the thick of that. Jim also is one of the people very much responsible in this country for elevating what we think of as traditional American desserts to the stuff of high culinary art, to the stuff of acclaim, to the same place that somebody like Larry Forgione took these savory dishes that comprise the American culinary canon, took the pastry side of things there. That's what, Jim is one of the people who did that. He and I were together recently because I went to Boston. He sort of helped orchestrate this. And I spoke at Boston University. Jim, twice a year, leaves his corporate job with Bon Appetit Management Company, which we talk about in the interview, and takes a week and teaches a pastry course at Boston University. He has been doing that for 29 years, since the inception of the culinary arts program there. He helped get me an invitation to speak to the students there as part of the Pepin lecture series. The talk was also open to the public. And I was in a kitchen classroom. Jim and I were there, interviewed by a wonderful woman named Megan Elias. And on the classroom wall, it was a kitchen classroom, there were framed photographs of one of Julia Child and one of Jacques Pepin. It was quite special to be there. The program at that school was designed and founded by Julia and Jacques. So that was quite something. And Jim has also been a wonderful champion of my book. He's arranged through his job for me to talk at places like Twitter and SAP and do book signings in these places. And it's just been wonderful. He was also a wonderful interview for the book. We spoke a few times as I was working on it. And I think you're going to love him. He's full of history. He's also full of, you know, I like to say this is a chef show, not a food show, but we do get into some of the science of baking and certain opinions he has about what it takes to be a good baker and be a good chef. And I'm someone who doesn't bake. This came up with Magnus Nilsson last week. But I am somebody who finds the discussion of baking to be quite interesting, maybe because I don't do it myself. It's something I am not temperamentally suited to, although maybe I'll get there as I mature. I do want to say, you know, as I look toward the end of this season and to the next season, that pastry chefs have been very much underrepresented on this show. That's something that Jim actually said to me in a private conversation once. And it's very true. We have had a number of former pastry chefs, like our first ever guest, Alex Stupak, or Emma Benson from Aquavit. But it's something that has been largely neglected. That is something I'm going to try to do better with in 2019. I'm going to hope to get a lot more pastry chefs on the show. I also want to say that, you know, it's very much on my mind, and it's just the way things have fallen, that the end of this season is very male heavy. Haven't had a female guest in a few episodes. There are two coming up. You know, I've said this before on the show, there are different types of diversity, and I do have quite a mix of international, geographic, cultural, and now with Jim being a pastry chef, disciplinary variety on the show. The gender balance is a little off at the moment. It's just the way it fell. It's something I am aware of. It was not intentional, but there were guests that I had a chance to get while they were in New York or while I was in Boston, and I think it was the right call. But for anyone who's noticed that, please know that it has not gone unnoticed by me, and it is a rare event for this show. So with that, I'm going to now set the stage. Jim and I met the day after our talk in Boston. We squatted, I guess I would say, in a banquet room on, I think it was the second floor of the Copley Plaza Hotel. We weren't supposed to be there, but there was nothing going on there. And we grabbed a room and helped ourselves to the space we needed and did our interview there before anybody was able to kick us out. I think you're going to really love hearing from Jim. I think you're going to love hearing from someone who was at the forefront of the American culinary movement. And with that, I'm going to ask you to imagine me and Jim Dodge in a banquet room at the Copley Plaza Hotel a few weeks back as we begin our conversation. Here you go. First of all, we had this night last night. We were at Boston University, talking about the early days, the 70s and 80s, the sort of American chef revolution is what I think of it as. Let me just throw this out there broadly while we're still sort of kind of in this time portal mentally. When you think about those times, because you were there for a lot of the beginnings of this stuff, what do you first think of when you think about yourself tiptoeing into the profession, when you think about realizing there were a lot of other young Americans doing the same thing? Like, what does that evoke for you, if I just throw it out there that broadly?
I think the enthusiasm at the time.
Yeah.
You know, and the eagerness for all of us young chefs to learn as much as we could about, mm-hmm. Just not about flavor and developing our palates, but also the ingredients. You know, we are all obsessed with finding out what makes great a dairy product, what makes great cheese, what makes the importance of a tree-ripe fruit like a peach or a nectarine or a plum.
Yeah, this all sounds very quaint today, right? But this
it
was
does.
This was an awakening that you all had. This was a whole new way of looking at food in this country.
It was, and I think also it, for many of us, it made us reflect our own childhoods and the heritage in our families, and also the traditions
mm-hmm.
that we took for advantage.
Yeah,
you know that, and didn't really appreciate how unique they were.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how you grew up, because I think it's really fascinating. Because the hospitality business was right there, but
right.
the path to what you ended up doing was very much not there, as far as your
correct.
Family went.
So right.
tell people a little bit about how you grew up.
Well, a very unique situation, probably similar to in Europe. I grew up in the family business, which was a luxury hotel, small resort hotels in the Lakes region of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started my apprenticeship in the family business, I was 10. And the first job was weeding flower gardens. And eventually worked in all the various departments of the hotel because it was our family's belief that you really needed to know the whole business. And
right.
then from there, I started working in the kitchen. I discovered I loved the kitchen, but particularly drawn to the pastry kitchen, mm-hmm. which was downstairs in the hotel. And the hotel was built on the side of a mountain, and the bakery or pastry kitchen was in the back.
Yeah.
And during cold winters, we loved to go there early in the morning because of the warmth of the baker's oven.
Mm-hmm.
And our pastry chef, her name was Lillian Drake. She was an older woman and very kind and like a grandmother to us. And
nationality?
She was Irish.
Okay.
And she would give us cookies and little pastries and tell us these great stories about one story was she took her mother's copper roasting pan and used it as a sled. Well, she went down a hill that was pretty rocky and brought it back and it was all dinged up and, you know, she got scolded.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we are around guests, we would never imagine doing anything like that, you
right.
know. But, you know, I have to reflect on that time.
Yeah.
She'd stop giving us cookies. She said, I'm going to run out and your father's going to be mad at me.
Uh-huh.
But then, you know, so there that fondness right away and then I had an opportunity after working in various kitchens when I was about 19 to have a two-year Swiss apprenticeship. This was the first time I had seen fine pastry like that. And I thought, this is something that would be great in my hotel that I had someday, because that was the anticipation. So I did that for 2 years.
That you would open your own place sometime?
I would have my
yeah.
own place, or at least manage my own
yeah.
place. That, and we were, myself and my siblings, that was what was expected. So I did that, and then after that, continued to work at other resorts in Florida, and then Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island, Michigan, to continue to develop my skill. Well, my parents were very upset with me. They wanted me to go back to college to get a business degree and then start working in the front of the house.
Yeah.
And so I made the decision to move to San Francisco.
To get a little...
To get the distance.
Yeah, to pursue what you wanted to.
Yeah, and I moved there because I wanted to work in a city hotel.
Yeah.
And at that time, San Francisco had a reputation of having a lot of fine hotels. And, so then I got the job at the Stanford Court. I was just turned 24.
Roughly what year are we talking?
1978.
Yeah.
And I was... it was a great opportunity. It was just when... You know, a lot of young Americans were discovering food. They had changing careers. Chez Panisse was well underway there then. And I had all this great product I could use.
Yeah. Can you talk for just a moment about the role of that hotel in the culinary moment back then? Because that there's a whole chapter in the book I just wrote.
Right.
About a dinner that took place there. But that dinner was far from the only thing that that hotel was known for. It was sort of a hub.
It was a culinary hub.
Yeah, how so?
Well, the Jim Nasikas, who created the hotel, had gone to the Swiss Hotel School. And if you know about hotel business, this is the finest hotel school in the country. And for Americans, after they graduate from Cornell, they go there for a semester or two. So that's the standard around the world. And so he established that standard of luxury and attention to detail. And he also felt that the restaurant was very important. And when he opened, they designed the hotel, the restaurant had its own identity and had a set address and a street address, an entrance. So people would check into the hotel and say, could I get a reservation at Forno's Ovens? They'd talk to the cashier. Oh, yes, and in fact, it's right here in our lobby. So by giving its own identity, hiring a top-notch culinary team, when top chefs from around the world would come, they would stay there. And Craig Claiborne was the one who actually wrote about it the first time, the level of luxury and good food.
Right. Claiborne was the New York Times food writer.
Yes. And then, so we had the finest chefs in the world would come and stay a week, a few days. And often they were going to Mondavi Vineyards for their great chef's series.
James Beard came through that hotel a lot, yeah? Julia Child?
Julia Charles. Actually, James, that was his West Coast cooking school.
Cooking school?
Cooking school.
He did a school at the hotel?
Yes. For about 6 weeks, he was there. And so they would take over the restaurant during lunch when they weren't, at that time, they didn't serve lunch.
Right.
And the thing about Forno's Ovens, the ovens was at the lowest level. It was tiered seating.
Okay.
So it was like a theater. James, who was studied opera, for him it was perfect.
Right.
He was actually in a director's stage.
Yeah.
So that brought a mixture of people, various chefs around from around the state, and then good home cooks, and a lot of food writers as well, and actors. Danny Kaye would come to those.
Right. Big foodie.
Big foodie. And the helpers were Chuck Williams of Williams-Sonoma and Marion Cunningham, who did the revision of the Fanny Farmer cookbook.
Amazing.
And, of course, I was in the pastry kitchen, and they'd be coming running with, something that a student had failed with and said, Jim, can you fix this? I'd say, oh, yes, I'll take care of it. Come back in half an hour.
Right.
Or an hour, and it would have been revived.
Did you have a feel? You're naming all these people, right, who most people only know from the pages of books or because their names are on awards or on a house.
Right.
Did you have a sense of where these reputations were headed, that you were in the middle of this sort of storied time? Did it feel like something important was happening, or were you too close to it to recognize that in being in the center of it?
in some way, I think I knew about it because I was meeting all these other young chefs from around the country who were exploring the same way I was.
Yeah.
Changing dining.
I'm struck that you went the pastry route as early as you did. I think a lot of people don't realize this. It was not an assumed thing that a restaurant would have a pastry chef in this country. In a city like New York, people may maybe bought their desserts from the same companies the way they did with bread for a long time. There were a couple of companies in Los Angeles that sold to restaurants. Mm-hmm. This is actually one of the things I think, in a lot of respects, I feel like Chez Panisse gets overcredited with a lot. One of the things I feel like is barely recognized is that restaurant opened in 1971 with a dedicated pastry chef.
That's right.
Which was sort of remarkable for the time, I think.
Yes, it was remarkable because during that period, pastry was actually a dying art.
How do you mean that?
Because hotels, which usually fine hotels, had good pastry shops.
Right.
In fact, the Fairmont in Nob Hill in San Francisco,
yeah.
They had three different departments in the pastry shop. It was huge.
Yeah.
They had one kitchen that just made the confections of petit four sec, petit four glacé, and chocolates.
Yeah.
All hand-piped. And was a group of Swiss and German and Austrian pastry chefs. Pastry chefs, actually, they were taking too many shortcuts. They were buying mixes. Mm. The salespeople were getting to them. I don't have to teach people anymore.
Right.
It's just easier. But when they compromised that, they compromised quality and flavor dramatically.
Yeah.
And then the owners said, I don't really need them, or I can buy it. It's just easier.
Yeah.
So when I was done my apprenticeship, it was hard for me to find a good job as a pastry chef.
Yeah.
And that's one reason I went to San Francisco.
Do you think if you had somehow discovered cooking, in some ways this is probably impossible to answer, but without the reference point, of growing up where you did, with that pastry chef, do you think you ever would have found your way to the pastry side of things?
Without going through, I don't think so. I don't think so. The first time I went to Switzerland, and I was given, the local cream from the dairy cow, from the small herd of dairy cows.
Yeah.
I drank and I said, oh, this is just like what I grew up on.
Right.
Because at that time, there were still small family farms.
Yeah.
They were still had Guernsey and Jersey cows.
Right.
Which produced the best milk and cream.
Yeah.
And they were well taken care of, humanely treated, well fed. They were happy cows.
Uh-huh.
So they produced great milk and dairy.
Yeah.
And I remember eating in season the wild strawberries there. Oh, that's the same as our field strawberries.
Yeah.
And so it's a similar climate.
Yeah.
So reflecting at that period, I thought, I guess what I grew up on was pretty special.
Uh-huh.
And also, when we had those field strawberries were only available 2 weeks, and that was it.
Yeah.
Just as the local raspberries, the blackberries, or the blueberries, short season.
Yeah.
Then you had to wait another year.
Yeah.
So that helped for me to appreciate the uniqueness of those things when they're fully ripe with full flavor.
So you came up at a time, a lot of the reference points you've mentioned so far in this conversation are European, right?
That's right.
When you start to turn your focus to American desserts,
yes.
How did you start to make that shift, and how was that received?
It really started when I was at the Stanford Court.
Right.
And And having that experience of Switzerland and New Hampshire, I thought, we really do have some great, simple, great desserts here. And so I would assess things, like banana cream pie was one.
Okay.
And I said to myself, what makes a great banana cream pie? Well, really good cream that's not ultra-pasteurized, because if it's ultra-pasteurized, it is heated to a very high temperature. They add chemicals to it, preservatives, which have a bitter tone afterwards. They usually reduce the fat content so that they substitute vegetable gums in it.
Uh-huh.
So, and that has an off flavor. So what you had to do, the home, professional cook or home cook, you start people started adding sugar and vanilla extract because they had to mask those flavors. If you use good heavy cream that doesn't have any other ingredient, it has a natural sweetness and it has a wonderful full flavor. And it whips easier
It's
and higher. So that's on top. And then the filling, most pastry chefs or cooks were using imitation banana flavoring. I got, I don't want to use that because that has an a natural flavor. And then the people would slice their bananas very thin. I thought, well, the great thing about fruit is identifying the feel. You know, when you bite into a banana, it's that unique texture.
Yeah.
And so I cut my bananas a little thicker.
Yeah.
And I don't put them in lemon juice or orange juice because I don't want that flavor. It's going to compromise the banana. And this is a tribute to the banana, this banana.
People would do that to keep it from oxidizing?
That's
right. And browning?
Yeah. Right. So the trick is once you cook your pastry cream, which is vanilla pudding, really.
Yeah.
You just, when it's still warm, you put the cut bananas in.
Yeah.
So that the oxygen does, they're not exposed to oxygen. And then the most important thing is the crust. And most people were not baking the crust enough. Or using butter. Shortening is neutral. It has no taste. But butter has a wonderful taste. And when it's baked with the flour, what happens, it tastes nutty.
Yeah.
And then it's crisp.
Yeah.
So it has to be golden brown. So then when you put a fork through, you go through the whipped cream.
Right.
It's light. Then the bananas and the pastry cream. And then the fork goes through the crust, and it's crisp. And then when you're eating it, the texture of the crust enhances the pastry cream and the whipped cream, and it's a great experience. So texture in dessert is extremely important.
Yeah.
And so when I envision a dessert, an American dessert, that was my journey. What are the characteristics in it that are going to make it the best?
When you started doing this, were people, I mean, at the time, right, you were applying a level of thoughtfulness, a level of finesse, a level of expertise, a level of what we would now call science.
Yeah.
To things that were sort of taken for granted, that were largely considered the purview of home kitchens.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned banana cream pie or, you know, I almost picture like a case at a diner.
Right.
You know?
That's right.
Were people stunned when they, when your versions of these things would come out, when people would taste these things? I would imagine that was a revelatory moment for them.
It was. In fact, some people who would come to me and say, you know, I hate bananas, but in Europe, banana cream pie, it's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because I was doing it just because it was the memories of my childhood and growing up. I was fortunate because in the resort, we ate very well, and my father bought great ingredients from the local small farms. We even had a sugar house. We made our own maple syrup. So, you know, back at the pastry kitchen, and then, you know, later on, Bradley Ogden, probably about right after the event at the Stanford Court for the ICP, where all these American chefs came together.
Right, which was 83, spring of 83.
Right. Well, Bradley opened an American-style restaurant at Campton Place.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot that helped bring more attention. Also, everybody was focusing on more American foods.
Yeah.
And but I had already started doing that.
The little bit of travel I've done internationally led me to this conclusion. The other thing that led me to what I'm about to say was years ago, Tom Valente, a chef in New York, and I did a book of recipes for people with diabetes, right? And when we got to the dessert chapter, the game we played with ourselves was how little sugar
Right.
Could we put in a dessert and still have it taste like a proper dessert?
Yeah.
And we were at some desserts, we were maybe putting in 20% of what would be in a typical recipe that you would find in an American cookbook, right?
That's right.
And the American palate, at least now, runs so sweet. The amount of sugar, I think, that Americans want in their dessert, you're just kind of raised to expect it, right? Was it the same back then?
It was
And did you back off that a little in your desserts for the sake of refinement or elegance or balance?
I did it very intentionally.
You did?
Almost, yes.
So what I'm saying you felt was true even back then?
Oh, it was horrible.
Or maybe
true.
Even, I would think, maybe even more so.
Much more so.
Because there was less awareness of high fructose corn syrup and all this stuff. Yeah.
And actually, that reminds me, I did have criticism at that time. There were a lot of people who said, your desserts, Jim, are not sweet enough.
Interesting.
But the thing is, with sugar is subtle, but it can be overwhelming. You know, that level of sweetness. If you have too much sugar, you're not going to, those bananas, the slight acidity in the bananas, you're not going to notice.
Yeah.
Strawberries are the same thing. Strawberries have are quite acidic and a unique acid to it. And a wonderful, almost can be a floral flavor. If you add a lot of sugar, you lose those subtleties.
Yeah.
And when you're done, it's overwhelming to consume that much sugar.
Yeah.
And I think that you just, you know, having a really wonderful pastry with a little less sugar in it and a smaller amount is very rewarding. And I used to give the analogy, well, you know, people like these deli-style or diner-style cakes, you know, they're huge. They're enough today for four people, one serving, right? That's because you keep eating because you're not satisfied.
I've never heard that
you're
before.
Not satisfied.
That's fascinating.
But if you have a small, wonderful chocolate cake that you're using really good ingredients, it's packed with flavor, you have great texture in it, then you're satisfied. You don't need a lot.
Yeah.
It's actually, last night when we were at BU, we served the lemon bars.
Yeah, they were delicious.
And it's a small bite. That's all you need because the crust was a nice, thick, buttery, brown, nutty flavor, and then the sharp, clean lemon filling, creamy.
Yeah.
You didn't need more than that.
Right.
You're satisfied.
Well, you just mentioned last night, so I didn't realize that you went back to the origins of this program here at Boston University.
That's right.
Can you talk a little about this? It was quite something to come into a kitchen classroom that had framed photographs of Jacques Pepin and Julia Child on the wall. And, you know, a lot of culinary-focused places have pictures of one or both of those people on the wall, especially Julia. But here in Boston, there was a stool in the room, and they said this used to be Julia's stool.
Right.
Julia was a presence here.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, so can you just speak to the... Well, first of all, this program, and I didn't realize that, you know, they said last night we're about to celebrate our 30th anniversary, and you've been here for 29 years, so you've been with this program since its inception.
Yes, so Julia and Jacques helped to start the program with then the director, Rebecca Alsid.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, I had been at the Stanford Court for a while and was known and actually had been teaching at small schools around the country and so had been already involved with culinary education. I had taken interns at the Stanford Court regularly. So when I was asked to teach at this at the Metropolitan College at Boston University, and I saw that the footprint of the kitchen and everything, which Jacques helped design, I thought, this is a great place to teach.
Wow.
And I've been coming, it's the longest institution I've taught at, and it keeps, I think that a good chef is a good teacher.
Yeah, sure.
And you have to be, because you can't do it by yourself. And there's a reward of sharing knowledge, just as the same reward of sharing good food from your customers. And students appreciate it. And it's a challenging because you also, I love the fact there are different personalities.
Yes.
And I adjust to for their needs, education needs, you know. And some people absorb information differently. And that's stimulating to me. And to see how much that they appreciate the techniques I'm showing them.
Yeah. How have students changed over the years? Have they? Do people come in with more knowledge than they came in with back when? Do they come in looking to do, you know, desserts, as food in general has in restaurants anyway, desserts have really changed. I mean, you know, there's desserts today that look like, you know, the old mousetrap game, you know?
Right, right. Well,
as opposed to sort of, you know, the variations on classics that you were doing.
Well, students have changed. I mean, there's still the different personalities reasons people are taking classes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they're pretty, because of the internet, because there's more food, TV, the awareness, and so many publications, people are generally more knowledgeable.
They come in with a higher baseline.
That's right. And it's a broader scope as well.
Yeah.
Because there's so many more ethnic influences now than there were.
Right.
So that's very interesting. I will say in pastry, there has been a trend to focus on the appearance, which I call sometimes it's architecture. So for me, the principles, and this is basically a European, well, it's a good philosophy for any good cuisine.
Sure.
So what's important to me are these things are equally as important. The eye appeal.
Yeah.
The flavor, the textures, and then how you feel after you eat it, you eat a full portion.
Right.
All those things are equally important. With pastry, unfortunately, there's been a shift to focus only on the appearance, ignore everything else.
Right.
So there are many desserts there. You know, I've been to restaurants, and all the desserts are kind of the same. They're all kind of mousses or things. They're so elaborately constructed, you know.
Yeah.
There's no flavor.
Yeah.
Or there's no balance either.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what's the reasoning for putting this sauce with these apples? Or this, it doesn't make sense. It hasn't done any. Or sometimes they're it's a total conflict. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Because I do believe on the plate that sometimes there's a journey you take, you know, when you, the main component, then all the accents, the different sauces or the creams that are bringing into it, or maybe a little hazelnut crisp, or maybe a little chocolate meringue or something like
becomes
that.
Becomes interactive.
Very, very much interactive.
Yeah, that's the word Alfred Portale from the Gotham used to use.
Yes.
About dishes that had different components, where you could sort of mix and match 2, 3, 4 different things in different combination as you eat through it.
Yeah.
And you become, as a diner, sort of a participant in the... You have a say in how you experience the dish.
Right. And that reminds me of I think it was sort of the 90s when there was a period of all sauces with little dots.
Right.
And there wasn't enough dot to...
It was a visual thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, you wanted more of that sauce so that you could have a little sauce with each bite, you know, and you were lucky if you had enough sauce for one bite.
Can you say a little more about the teaching thing? Because it is so interesting to me. You know, we were just talking about Julia Child.
Right.
And it's a funny historical footnote. Her television show was called The French Chef. But she never liked that title.
No.
Sarah Moulton told me this.
No.
Because she had never been a chef, meaning she had never cooked in a restaurant. That's what a chef is.
Right.
You know, when people still say this, but they used to say it way more 20 years ago, you know, my friend's a wonderful home chef.
That's right.
That's not a chef.
No.
Part of being a chef is running a team. I'm just not even, this isn't even opinion, right? This is what it means. And I like to say, you know, there's no Emily Dickinsons in the in the food world. You know, you to be a chef, you need a restaurant, you need customers. No one gets discovered, you know, the way Dickinson did, you know, after they're gone, right? Mm-hmm. You practice it. You need a place to ply your trade, right?
That's right.
And you need, as you said a minute ago, but I just love you to expand on it, you need to be able to teach, if nothing else, how to get what you as the chef, with what you as the person with the vision for that particular restaurant want to have come out of the kitchen, right? Your vision, your palate, yes. Here's what we're going for here. Can you speak to that role? Because I think this is such an undervalued aspect of what your career demands.
Right. Well, it's why the BU program was so appealing to me, partly because of two mentors, Julia Child and Jacques Pepin, who are great educators. They were very and both had, and great students as well, because they were always wanting to learn new technique, better techniques.
Yeah.
And that was the atmosphere that the two of them created at that school.
Yes.
And that helped me. This is a negative. There on the internet, there is so much bad information out there, particularly about pastry.
Yeah.
That I'm all the time, I mean, for 30 years, I have been correcting bad technique.
Yeah.
And that is even more so now.
Yeah.
Because there's too many people communicating who aren't really authorities.
Yeah, well, this is the downside. I just had this conversation recently with Chandra Ram on this show, who's the editor of Plate Magazine. Right. It's the downside of the democratization that the internet brings.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is anybody can have a platform whether or not you know what you're talking about.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, you know, I was teaching the students how to make doughs.
Right.
You know, and how to roll a dough. And, you know, people say don't use much flour when you're rolling up a dough. Well, you have to use flour. Otherwise, the dough sticks to the counter. It sticks to the rolling
pin. Yeah, yeah.
You know, use a lot of flour. Roll efficiently. Don't take your time. And then when you're done, brush all the flour off with a soft brush.
Yeah.
And then it's so much easier to roll.
Right.
And the other technique is people roll in one direction. When you roll in one direction, you're picking up the rolling pin and you're dropping it on the dough, on the edge of the dough. You're pounding the dough. You're making that dough, if you're making a pie dough, you're making it tough by pounding it like that. It's better to put the rolling pin in the middle, roll to the top and the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And and then gently place the rolling pin on the dough.
Yeah.
So it's technique like that I'm, till I die, I'm sure I'm still going to be.
You're fighting against a big tide.
That's right. Yeah. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a tiny bride, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
This program is brought to you by Jewel Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman Wadler. I am the executive director of HRN and a real-life Jewel user. When you cook with Jewel, there's zero guesswork, so steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Paired app is intuitive to use and preloaded with all the recipes you'll need, and it has a great visual doneness guide. Jewel is awesome for holiday cooking. It's easy to cook for a crowd, and it's perfectly precise, so you can focus on entertaining without worrying about checking food temps, while Jewel does all the work. You can try out new cuts fearlessly. One of the best things I ever made sous vide was a juicy, tender heritage goose with juniper berries, and it was life-changing. And pro tip, Jewel is small and packs easily, so you can sneak it along on your holiday travels to be this season's food hero everywhere you go. With Jewel, you get perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/JOULE, code HRN. And happy holidays from all of us at Team HRN.
Welcome back to the show. I'm going to return you in just a moment to the rest of my interview with Jim Dodge. As always, I do want to remind you that I would love it if you subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher. It's free. No reason not to do that. It'll just pop up in your feed once a week, or this season, as I have a serious backlog, twice a week. We're still going to be dropping shows twice a week through the end of the year. So subscribe and you won't miss a thing. Also, if you would like to follow us on Instagram, the handle is @ChefPodcast. I do post a notice there with an image every time we have a new show. So that's another way to keep up. And if you drop us a review or just a rating at Apple's iTunes store, it does help people find the show, and I would really appreciate it. It does help people find the show, and we would really appreciate it. And with that, here you go. Here's the rest of my interview with Chef Jim Dodge. I hope you enjoy it. You've written books?
Yes, that's right.
Can you talk about that experience when you started doing it? Because here again, this is now seen almost like a rite of passage for any successful chef in this country. This again was a new thing that Americans started writing cookbooks.
That's right. Yeah.
American chefs.
American
people
chefs.
People who were coming from a restaurant background.
And actually, that's reflective on being a teacher.
Yeah.
Because what that taught me is when I had 20 or 30 students in front of me, I understood what people needed to know, particularly home cooks.
Right.
I became a better manager because I didn't assume people knew things. I learned how to even structure a recipe. So, you know, I'd break it up into steps. So if I had an intern, I'd say, okay, just go down to this point, stop, and then ask for me. So when I started teaching, people kept saying, you should write a book. You should write a book.
Yeah.
And then this also brings back to that wonderful time in the 70s and 80s. When we were all these young Americans who were cooking and writing about food, I got a lot of support.
Yeah.
So my agent, Alice Waters, suggested the agent I got.
Uh-huh.
I needed a co-author because I had a full-time job. I needed somebody to help me finish that book. So Barbara Tropp from China Moon.
Yeah.
Suggested a writer, you know, so had all this tremendous support.
It's amazing.
The other exciting thing about that time too is people like Jacques and Julia, such great mentors. At that point in their lives, they were so successful and loved the generosity. They donated so much time to charities. And that's been very important to me, to give back. So I give back in my teaching,
yep.
And I give back my free time the other night I did a cooking demonstration, how to make an apple pie at America's Test Kitchen for community servings, which provides meals for families of low income that have medical issues.
Wow.
Until they're well enough.
Right.
So those things... And they're important to me, and I feel good about myself.
Can you, for a minute, it's so interesting to me, you still teach, you've made time in your life to do that, but you have a very different job now that takes up a lot of your time. Can you speak to what you're doing and who you're doing it for and what that entails and the amount of time you're on the road? And
I'm very fortunate because I work now for Bon Appetit Management Company, which is... a high-end food service company that focuses on providing restaurant-quality food at cultural centers like the Getty Center in Los Angeles, universities like MIT, Brown here in Boston, University of San Francisco,
yep.
And then corporations such as Google and other high-tech businesses. Around the country. So my job is director of special culinary programs. And actually a lot of that is culinary education because unlike other food service companies, we don't have standardized menus, we don't have standardized recipes. Each cafe, restaurant is run as an independent restaurant. So the general manager and the chef create their own menus. Mm. My job is to stimulate them by having these trainings, by bringing in different chefs. Like last year we did Persian.
Uh-huh.
So there's a friend of mine, Ha Sayer, who is an excellent Persian chef in Mediterranean, and he did a training for us. We did one on the five culinary regions of China. Jatila taught that, did that training for us.
Yeah.
And these are extensive manuals,
mm-hmm.
with not just the recipes, but the culture.
Yeah.
Because we need to do authentic. So our chefs need to understand not just the cuisine, but the history.
Yeah.
And the food culture.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I do is I bring in cookbook authors to our accounts.
Right.
For signings.
Yeah. I was lucky to be one of those people this year.
And so what that does, it not only stimulates our customers who eat in our cafes, but also our staff.
Yeah.
Because then they get to meet authors like you.
Yeah.
And cook different food, and it's very, very exciting.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, you took me to a couple of accounts back in the spring.
Right.
And the energy was great. It was they did special lunches based on the chefs in the book.
That's right.
Yeah, it was really fun. Okay, last question. I have a philosophical question I want to ask you. Years ago, I won't say who because I think you have a different point of view, but a very well-known pastry chef said to me, chefs are surgeons, pastry chefs are pharmacists, okay? And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, you know, being a chef is like you're doing triage and it's the heat of service and it's organized chaos and da-da-da-da. Pastry chef, it's you measure, you do this, you do that. That there's no, you know, it's all preordained, right? You and I had dinner last night and we were talking. You don't ascribe to that view of the pastry art.
I don't, because I think there are a lot of pastry chefs who are very exacting.
Yeah.
It's their personalities, and that's how they apply it to their art. But again, people will dispute this, and I say, well, do you have a mother or a grandmother who made pie dough by hand or made pasta by hand? Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, they reflect, oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I said, did they measure? Well, no. I said, see? They did it by feel. They did it by touch.
Right.
So when they're pulling in the flour, they're adding the egg or whatever, they know just by feel how much. And this was a very, I had a very unique moment when I was invited to France to stay. A good friend of mine was renting a chateau for a milestone birthday. She invited friends to come.
Great.
And so I was in Provence and at the chateau, and she said, okay, Jim, make desserts. Well, I didn't bring any recipes with me.
Right.
I said, okay. So I went down to the market. I just bought flour. I bought butter. I bought fruit, whatever. And there were actually cherries in the beautiful cherries at the chateau. So anyways, I did it by feel. I thought, okay, I'm just going to do it. At the Swiss pastry shop, I had been taught how to make doughs by hand. And I wanted to make this kind of thumbprint cookie.
Yeah.
So I just did it, and sort of by memory. And then I made these wonderful cookies. I had reduced the cherries a little bit, put it in the middle, and I had to hide them because they were for dinner and people would find them and eat them otherwise.
Right.
And everyone raved about it. Well, I came back, was like, okay, now I got to figure out the recipe. It took me 3 weeks to figure out the exact amount for that recipe.
Right.
But it really opened my eye. And the great thing about working in a small pastry shop like that where we made things by hand, you slow down the process. So that you're feeling, when you're making, creaming the butter with a flour and blending it into the flour, you feel how you're manipulating that butter and how it's changing.
Yeah.
So that when you are on a mixer, you can stop it, you can feel the dough, you know exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
My staff used to marvel at me because they'd say, Jim, I don't know what's going on here. This mix is not right, or what. I'd go over and feel it and this and that and analyze it and say, well, you didn't do this or that. And that was a gift from having that knowledge, that skill.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that, and the other thing is the ingredients change. The climate changes.
Yeah.
If I'm in Florida baking, I'm going to use a little less water in my pie dough because it's so humid.
Yeah.
If I'm in Palm Springs, California, it's bone dry, I'm going to have to add more water. The flour dries out. The flour, if it's humid, the flour absorbs more moisture.
Sure.
Butter changes, you know.
The degree of sweetness of all the different fruits.
Yes, that's right. So adjust the sugar.
Yeah.
So that's why you can be successful baking exactly, but you're not going to have the epitome of desserts. I mean, baking a sponge cake. So the way I test a sponge cake is not by the time and temperature,
And
not just about the general appearance. You know, it will shrink from the edge just a little bit. The top will spring a little bit, spring. But if you do that, if it springs back the center, you're overbaking the cake. Because when you take it out, with all baked goods, you've increased the heat internally so much, it's 350 degrees or 325. You take it out, it's still cooking.
Carryover.
So when you touch the center, it should feel set and gently spring a little bit, not full.
Right.
Take it out, it will finish cooking, it will be moist, tender, perfect.
This is what I call the leap of faith moment in cooking.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. Like it's like, you know, when you sometimes you'll, you know, I don't really bake much, but you know, I'll have something that's close to done in the oven and I'll turn the oven off and let it, let it coast, right? Or, you know, when you rest meat, right? And the bigger the cut, the more the leap of faith. But you have to know, or fish, you got to get comfortable. Even I, who've never worked in a restaurant kitchen, know you have to get comfortable removing things from the heat source before they're where you want them.
So in my training, I was in the cuisine first.
Yeah.
So when I went into pastry, you know, I brought that with me.
Yes.
You know, because if you're on the line, you're sauteing, well, you can adjust things.
So do you think there's less of, in an ideal world, as you see the culinary world, the professional kitchen, do you feel like there's less of a line between what a quote-unquote savory person does and what a quote-unquote pastry person does? Do you see those as not as separate as most people do in terms of how it's done, in terms
generally
of the practice?
Generally speaking, yes, that's right. The difference is most of us need to know how to cook in our lives. You don't need to know how to bake. Mm. The ingredients are different. They react differently. There's a lot less knowledge about the ingredients in baking.
Yeah.
So that's the big division. So once you understand the role of sugar, the role of flour, the role of the fat, whatever, then you know what to adjust. So in baking, for instance, sugar is not a dry ingredient.
Right.
It's a liquid because when it has contact with liquid or heat, it liquefies. An example, if you put sugar in a bowl, you're making a caramel, it's a liquid.
Yeah.
So if you're reducing the sugar more than a lot, you have to increase a little liquid to compensate for that. Low moisture butter, European style butter, you know, is it's the same thing. You know, it's when you're whipping butter for a butter cream with low moisture, it doesn't have the water in it. So it's going to aerate much more. You have a much stronger structure.
Yeah.
So you're going to have a better pound cake, a better muffin. Your dough, the pie dough, when you roll out, because it's denser fat, it's much easier to roll out. If you're making a croissant or puff pastry, same thing. You want to use low moisture butter.
Yeah.
If you're using regular butter with more moisture in it, that takes a lot more patience, focus, and skill because you're using an inferior product.
Well, it's been great talking to you again.
Great talking to you.
Thanks for sharing all this with our listeners. I'm really glad we were able to get you on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I want to thank Jim Dodge. Jim, not just for that wonderful interview, but also for your incredible and very moving support of my book. You and I, as you know, did not know each other until we had our first sit down for that book, but I really think of you as a friend, and you've just been great. Caitlin in absentia, thanks for being my co-pilot here most of the time. Vitor, our engineer, thank you for doing double duty this season and splicing these things together. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we will see you back here in just a few days on Andrew Talks to Chefs.